Greetings and felicitous Christmas solicitations, my excellent listeners. Welcome to this December 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this last science podcast of the year, Jim Campanella. Forgive me, I'm recovering from a cold. Before we get started with science stories, let me get a couple of listener comments out of the way that have to do with the science podcast itself. First, there have been a number of listeners who emailed me who were upset about some of the things that I said last month in November's podcast about science students. The listeners who emailed me did not identify themselves as science students, but from their ire toward my comments, I can only guess that they were taking my comments as personal insults. If you missed last month's podcast, you may want to listen, but to put it succinctly, I was talking about why U.S. math and science students fail. And I gave several hypotheses on why that may be and why the U.S. in general seems to be floundering right now in science, math, and engineering. I was described by those listeners who wrote to me with a number of colorful comments. The less colorful of those terms were pompous, arrogant, snide, condescending, and thoughtless. Probably the most colorful was pedantic ass clown, which I kind of like, by the way. It has a certain assonance to it. It's kind of poetic. I have a couple of responses. Not defenses, responses to their emails. I never said that American science students are ignorant, dumb, or useless in any way. What I was trying to get across is that sometimes, no matter how smart a student is, they make the wrong choices and head in a direction for which they are simply not suited. Not everybody is a Rudy who will win out no matter what the circumstances. Rudies are the exception, not the rule. I wanted to be an astrophysicist when I started my science career in college. It took me exactly one semester to realize that despite the fact that I had gotten A's in math all through high school, there was no way I would ever be good enough at serious math to go into physics. It takes a special mind to do that, one that I do not have. Does that mean that I'm an idiot because I had so much trouble with complex calculus? No. It simply means that I was not cut out for it. I did not have the proper aptitude. And what did I do about it? Did I insist that I was going to become a physicist no matter what? Did I take courses over and over again that I would be doomed to repeat? No. I got out of it and went into biology, another science which I enjoyed immensely and where my understanding of math and statistics was more than enough to get me by. That was the point I was trying to make. I have seen too many students who are simply not suited for science. Are they idiots and a waste of breathable atmosphere? No, they're simply not suited. I still insist that kids who are told they can be anything they want to be are being sold a load of baloney by grade schools. I cannot be a jockey because I am 100 pounds too heavy, no matter how much I like horses. I cannot be an NBA basketball player because I am about a foot too short. Yes, Harvard and Princeton are having the same problems as lowly state schools with students not being able to survive the sciences and win through with a degree. And this actually supports what I'm saying. This phenomenon has nothing to do with the intelligence of the students, because Ivy League students are among the smartest in the world. Given that truism, what we are seeing must have more to do with aptitude and whether they are suited to being scientists in today's world than anything else. And to you multiple American listeners who said that maybe professors like me are the problem and not them, here is a marvelous quote from Terry Pratchett. Quote,
"There is a significant difference between Europeans and Americans. A European says, 'I cannot understand this. What is wrong with me?' While an American says, 'I cannot understand this. What is wrong with him?'" Unquote. I think you get my drift.
Now, about my arrogance. In order to get to a point in academia where you survive to be a tenured professor, in charge of a lab, and doing your own research work, you have to have a certain amount of self-confidence. I know that I sound like I am preaching to you guys sometimes, but that attitude is something that has to be developed to survive in academia. If you say things in a hesitant or self-questioning manner, you should just give up the ghost, because you will never, ever be able to convince students, let alone your colleagues, that what you are saying is true. And sadly, that is completely independent of the actual veracity of whatever the topic is. Enough of that. The other emails that I've gotten involve asking me why I do not do a year-end roundup of science like they do in popular science magazines. Here's the quick answer, because I don't like year-end roundups. Sorry, if you really want a roundup, then go listen to my 11 other science podcasts from earlier in the year. They are all archived at ubulaaudio.com. I would much rather look ahead to new stuff than get bogged down doing a podcast that celebrates the old. Which brings us to the new stories. Yay! The first actual story involves sex. One of the big questions in biology has always been, why is there sex? What's the advantage of sex? There are plenty of organisms out there which do not have sex, and they reproduce without the mix of genetic information between two mates. Bacteria reproduce just fine by themselves, algae, amoeba, fungi of all kinds, and they've done fine for millions of years, so why bother? Wouldn't it be better to have asexual females who just do all the work by themselves and don't need males? Doesn't mating take a lot of time and energy that could be better put to furthering survival for an organism, whether that organism be a plant or an animal? Well, the first response that you would get from most geneticists or evolutionary biologists is that sex is needed for gene shuffling in an organism. It provides a way of bringing in new DNA variants and creates genetic diversity. As I pointed out in previous podcasts, the key to genetic health is genetic diversity. As long as the DNA sequence in a population is varied, that helps ensure that the organism will survive when the environment around it changes. And it is not just the environment that populations have to contend with. Organisms need to be able to survive parasites that prey upon them. Whether those parasites be viral or bacterial or even more complex, like fungal parasites. As I told my microbial genetics class a couple of weeks ago, the entire history of hosts and parasites is a war in which both sides try to outdo the other to get a biological advantage. Connecting on this idea of trying to get an advantage to the process of sexual reproduction a few years ago, evolutionary biologists suggested something that they called the Red Queen hypothesis. This hypothesis proposes that sex allows plants and animals to stay one step ahead in their endless arms race against co-evolving parasites. If you remember the advice that the Red Queen gave to Allison through the looking glass, she said that you had to keep running faster just to stay in one place. Here's the exact quote. Quote,
"Now here you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that."
Unquote. Dr. Levy Moran and his colleagues at the University of Indiana have just published a paper in a recent issue of the journal Science that helps support the Red Queen hypothesis and its relation to the evolution of sex. The title of Moran's paper is "Running with the Red Queen: Host Parasite Coevolution Selects for Biparental Sex." Moran set the nematode, the small worm, Xenorhabditis elegans, against its natural parasite, which is a bacterium called Serratia marcescens. Remember that we were saying, why bother having males? Well, C. elegans apparently took that to heart during evolution. Most C. elegans, about 80% of them, are hermaphrodites, and they reproduce by self-fertilization. And only about 20% of the time will hermaphrodite worms reproduce by mating with rare males. Now here's the cool part. When Moran forced the wild-type worms to live constantly with their bacterial parasites for 30 worm generations, the rate of biparental breeding in the population increased from that low 20% to nearly 90%. In a control, when the bacterial parasites infected mutant worms that couldn't mate at all with males, the worms were driven into extinction in 10 generations. So there you have it. Apparently sex, and lots of sex, somehow kept the worms alive, and the absence of sexual reproduction led to the doom of the little nematodes. They did some further experiments to see how the bacteria were affected. Because the bacteria and the worms both can be frozen and later reanimated, the team revived the original ancestral bacteria and host and compared them with their micro-evolved descendants. When Moran infected the original first-generation worms with the evolved parasites arisen from 30 generations of breeding, he saw that the evolved bacteria killed worms 2 to 3 times more effectively than their ancestors. However, when these newly evolved bacteria infected the 30th generation co-evolved worms, They were no more effective at killing them than the first generation parasites were at killing the first generation worms. What does that mean? Well, the take-home message is that while parasites evolved to become nastier, the worms simultaneously evolved to resist them, and both stayed pretty much where they were to begin with. And the outcome is exactly what the Red Queen hypothesis predicts. Both the parasite and the host have to keep running to stay in exactly the same place. So this is some serious evidence that males should not be gotten rid of quite yet. The advantages that males bring to the table do make their costs bearable. The presence of the males in the case of the worms allowed them to run slightly faster than the bacteria, and so be able to survive. Next story. For a long time, geneticists have been trying to implant new genes in humans who are born with genetic abnormalities. The name for this process has been gene therapy, and it has been a long staple of speculative fiction. Gene therapy has been on the outs for the last decade for two reasons. The first reason is the technical one. To perform gene therapy so that it will have some effect on the ill patient, you need to be able to get the gene into their tissue or tissues and have that gene expressed in the long term so that the protein product produced is made at high enough concentrations and continuously to help the patient. Well, we have simply not been able to do that very well. A safe method of getting genes into tissues has not been available. The major method that has worked with mice has been to use retroviruses to carry DNA into the cells and then insert that DNA into chromosomes. Retroviruses, like herpes and HIV, do have the ability to insert DNA into genomes. There are a couple of problems with that approach, though. First, the DNA ends up being inserted randomly into the DNA, potentially creating mutations. The other problem is that using viruses like that, even disarmed viruses, can still cause some severe immune reactions. Which brings us to problem number two of gene therapy. Is it safe? In 1999, 18-year-old Jesse Gelsinger had a rare liver disease called ornithine transcarbamylase disorder. This is a liver disease that can be a serious problem in many people with a genetic deficiency, but Jesse was just fine with drugs and injections. He was very healthy. And despite the fact that Jesse would not benefit from gene therapy, he agreed to undergo the experimental procedure. He volunteered because the researchers at the University of Pennsylvania told him it would further science. Someday they told him the results might help cure sick babies, quote-unquote. He was told that it was safe and it would help the world. The researchers at Penn pumped him full of genetically altered viruses, and then like something out of a bad horror novel, things went wrong. Jesse's immune system reacted violently to the viral carriers used by the researchers. He reacted so violently, in fact, that he ended up going into immune system shock and dying in September of 1999. It turned into a real-life horror show for Jesse's parents, and to make matters worse, the doctors who led the Penn State research had a financial interest in the company that funded it. And that is a fundamental ethics violation in any kind of human clinical research. In 2003, gene therapy trials for severe combined immunodeficiency syndrome, or SCIDS, caused leukemia in three children. Remember that I said that retroviruses can insert themselves randomly into a chromosome? If you're a lab rat who's not expected to be long for this world anyway, that's fine. But if you're a human and a child, then it can cause a horrendous outcome. If a gene, such as a tumor suppressor gene, gets knocked out by an insertion like that, viral gene therapy may cause cancer, and it did in these children. 10 of the children suffering from the immunosuppression disease were basically cured in the French study, and at first that was greeted with great excitement as a breakthrough in gene therapy. But of those three kids who later developed leukemia, one of them died. A 70% survival rate for a treatment that is supposed to be safe is not exactly fantastic. Most recently, in July 2007, a 36-year-old woman with rheumatoid arthritis died while participating in a gene therapy clinical trial. Some experts say that she shouldn't have received such an unpredictable, potentially dangerous treatment in the first place. Ms. Jolie Moore was married and the mother of a 5-year-old daughter, and she was able to lead a full and active life with existing drugs keeping her disease under control. But she entered the experimental trials anyway, and again, she paid the ultimate price for that. These three stories point up why gene therapy has gotten such a bad name in recent years. But maybe that will change now. Genetic blood diseases are the perfect problems to benefit from gene therapy. You put in the gene for the protein that's lacking, and it gets circulated into the blood, and the person is cured. The December 10th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine reports one of the first serious breakthroughs in gene therapy in the last 20 years. Dr. John Tisdale of Johns Hopkins and his colleagues were able to transplant the missing gene products to hemophilia B patients that would save their lives. Hemophilia B is a common form of hemophilia where blood fails to clot properly. Anyone with this particular form of the disease must receive injections of a clotting compound called factor 9. Without the clotting compound, they bleed from cuts, scratches, bruises, or even internally. In the new study, 4 out of the 6 hemophilia patients experimentally given the gene therapy for the factor 9 clotting gene no longer need to receive the clotting compound injections any longer. The researchers treated 6 men ages 27 to 64 with gene therapy using a relatively harmless virus called cytomegalovirus. They coupled genetic components called promoters that induce liver cells to make the factor 9 protein into a special plasmid construct. Amazingly, each patient received a single infusion of the therapy, which they called serotype 8 pseudotyped self-complementary adenovirus-associated virus vector in the journal article. Because the researchers were worried about problems, such as they saw previously in studies like this, they have now monitored the men for 9 to 20 months. 4 of the men who received medium or high doses of the genetic therapy have made enough factor 9 protein in their livers to stop needing exogenous injections of the protein. 2 of the men on lower dosages of the treatment made a lot less of the factor 9 and still needed to get their exogenous injections, but they were able to cut back to 1 injection every 10 to 14 days after the treatment, which is still a major breakthrough. According to the authors, quote, "The cytomegalovirus was chosen in part because it is unlikely that many people receiving it would have been exposed to it and already made antibodies against it. That means they were much less likely to have a really nasty immunological reaction, like the one that made Jesse Gelsinger so ill. The virus was also chosen because it specifically targets liver cells, which make factor 9. And although cytomegalovirus 8 enters a cell, it does not integrate with DNA material in the chromosomes. That sidesteps one of the biggest problems of the previous treatment, like the one that caused leukemia in those children, and it greatly reduces any risk that the therapy will interfere with normal cell function by random DNA insertion. The paper points out the one serious drawback with the procedure. It can be done only once with this virus. You cannot repeat the gene therapy with the virus because once a patient has been exposed to it, his immune system will recognize if he's exposed again. That means that the second dose of the cytomegalovirus type 8 will cause a massive immune reaction that could potentially lead to a lethal immune reaction like Jesse Gelsinger's. The author says this should not be a problem because they have dozens of other rare cytomegalovirus strains that have not been used and could be used for further treatment in the same person, although they haven't done that yet. One of the coolest results is that earlier experiments in large animals have shown that this process results in therapy that could last 10 years or longer after treatment. The authors say that further testing in people is planned, but these really are the most promising results for gene therapy in the last 20 years. This could be a real hope for lots of sick people out there. The next story of the evening is just a bit on the strange side. When I first read it, my immediate response was, "What in the heck? I can't believe that a granting agency has spent money on this research. This is why the public screams about how useless and wasteful basic science research is." And then I discovered on further examination of the paper that the work was self-funded by a university researcher, and my ire was quenched. Quenched? No. So what is this unorthodox work? It is a physical and energetic analysis of backward human running. Yes, you heard that correctly. Dr. Giovanni Cavagna and collaborators at the University of Milano decided that the world needed to know why there is a greater step frequency and energy expenditure in backwards versus forward running in humans. His work was published this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology. Yes, there have been previous studies on this topic, hence it is known that it does take more energy and steps to run backwards than forwards. What was not known are the differences in the motion of the center of mass of the body associated with these findings on speed and steps. Cavagna measured the differences on 9 trained runners during backwards and forwards running steps on a treadmill moving anywhere between 3 and 17 kilometers per hour. In contrast to previous reports, he found that the maximal upward acceleration of the center of mass and the aerial phase averaged over the whole speed range from 3 to 17 kph are greater in backward running than in forward running. Opposite to forward running, the impulse on the ground is directed more vertically during the push at the end of stance than during the break at the beginning of stance. The higher step frequency in backward running is explained by a greater mass-specific vertical stiffness of the bouncing system, he says, resulting in a shorter duration of the lower part of the vertical oscillation of the center of mass when the force is greater than body weight. That was all a quote, by the way. With a similar duration of the upper part of the body when the force is lower than body weight. Like a catapult, muscles and tendons are stretched more slowly during the braking at the beginning of the stance, and they shorten more rapidly during the push at the end of the stance. Cavagna suggests that the catapult-like mechanism of backwards running, although it requires more energy usage and does not provide a smoother ride, may be useful. Running backwards may allow a safer stretch-shorten cycle of muscles and tendons, and may be good for athletes who are suffering muscle or joint injuries and still need to work out. It is a strange but interesting thought. My worry is that all these athletes running around fields backwards would simply be falling down or even falling over each other in their endeavors to recover. The next story has to do with snakes. Now, frankly, I do not know a lot about snakes. I do not know a lot about animals. I'm not a naturalist. By training, I'm a geneticist and a molecular biologist. That means I understand how DNA works in pretty much all animals and plants. However, that also means I have a limited knowledge base sometimes on a particular animal species and their anatomy and their physiology. This has been annoying sometimes when I'm asked a particular question by my kids about an animal which, frankly, I don't know a lot about. A couple of months back, my 5-year-old daughter asked me how snakes hear when they don't have any ears. I hemmed and hawed and eventually told her they have very small pinhole-like ears that we just can't see. That was a guess. That was wrong. Snakes do not have ears open to the air like most mammals do. So my pinhole hypothesis was nothing more than that, and it was a wrong hypothesis. My daughter was closer to the truth than I was in this case, and that is a bit sobering. Coincidentally, in this month's Journal of Experimental Biology, Dr. Christian Christensen and his colleagues examine how snakes hear. Apparently, there has been quite a bit of controversy about this for years, which I didn't even know existed. Some scientists have proposed that snakes cannot hear because they have neither external ears or an ear drum. They have lost both of those in evolution and now have only an inner ear attached to a single middle ear bone. In short, they do not have any of the apparatus that can sense vibrations in the air. So do they even hear has been the question for decades. Dr. Christensen hypothesized that one way that snakes might actually be able to detect pressure waves in the air, that is sound, is if they detect sound through sound-induced mechanical vibrations through their bodies. That is, the sound is detected by their bones and/or body and then transmitted to their ears. Christensen played sounds ranging in pitch from 80 to 1,000 hertz at volumes between 50 and 110 decibels for royal pythons. He then recorded electrical responses in the snake's cranial nerves and their brain stems. He then increased the volume of the stimulus until he recorded a measurable electrical signal in the brainstem, and he found that snakes could hear very loud airborne sounds. The sounds had to be about 10,000 times louder than the softest sounds that can be heard by humans. The pythons were also most sensitive to low frequencies between 80 to 160 hertz, and their sensitivity decreased at higher frequencies. So Christensen found pretty strong evidence that snakes can hear. His next task was to determine how the snakes could hear even loud sounds. How did that sound get to the snake's vibration-sensitive inner ear? As low-frequency sounds are efficiently carried by solid materials, the group hypothesized that sound vibrations could be transmitted from the ground into the snake's body where it was then detected. Christensen measured vibrations generated on the surface upon which the snakes were lying on a loudspeaker suspended above a platform. Again, he recorded the electrical responses to the vibrations, and he found that the animals responded well to 80 hertz vibrations, but they could only detect the low-frequency sounds, which carried well through the substrate, and not the high-frequency sounds. So his final question was, how were snakes able to sense higher-pitched sounds? Christensen said, quote, "We humans can hear by bone conduction in water. That could be another way of sending sound," unquote. So the researchers decided to test whether animals can sense their own skulls vibrating in response to sound. They attached very sensitive vibration meters to the snakes' heads and measured the mechanical vibrations induced in the head by loud airborne sounds that were just above the snakes' hearing thresholds. Christensen found that indeed these skull vibrations were the same intensity as the minimal mechanical vibrations that the animals could sense. So instead of responding to sound pressure, the snakes responded to vibrations transmitted directly from the air to their skeletons. Okay, so that's how a snake hears. And it's very cool. And it fills in a gap in my knowledge pretty nicely. I suppose I had better go back to my daughter and clarify the whole issue. The last story of the night is about cans of food and bisphenol A. I am frankly getting sick of these monthly BPA updates. I have moved from being very concerned to annoyed and terrified. I cannot believe that we as humans have allowed manufacturers of just about everything that we eat and come into contact with to pollute our environment. You may have heard this latest one, but let me fill you in on the new horror if you haven't heard about the newest source of BPA in our diets. Dr. Gregory Noonan and his collaborators from the FDA just published a paper in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. This was about a month ago. And the paper shows very strong evidence that BPA is present in high quantities in metal canned foods. BPA, you may remember, is a nasty compound that mimics estrogen and is a component in most plastics. Noonan and his group found BPA tainting 71 of 78 canned goods they sampled from a grocery store. That is slightly more than 90%. They also tested frozen green beans and peas that had been sold in plastic bags as a control. As expected, neither of the frozen vegetables contained BPA. Presumably, the BPA contamination in the can comes from leaching from the plastic can liner, not from the metal of the cans themselves. The lowest concentration of BPA in canned food, which was 2.6 parts per billion, occurred in canned peas, although I suspect it had nothing to do with it being peas. It just happened to be that can that was the lowest. The contamination of green beans varied by 30-fold in different cans, with the highest being 730 parts per billion. Pasta, pork and beans, chili, soup, and fruit varied less, typically hosting BPA at levels between 10 and 80 parts per billion. The contamination had nothing to do with whether it was a store brand or a name brand either. Also, canned organic food seemed to be just as contaminated. What does all this variation imply? Well, the paper states, quote, "There are few clear trends to the data," unquote. Noonan also adds, quote, "Owing to the broad variation in concentrations witnessed here in the U.S., comparing BPA data from overseas products to U.S. foods is not overly informative," unquote. Even just over-the-border comparisons apparently can be challenging. Canadian canned tuna hosted 9 to more than 500 parts per billion BPA, well in excess of the 4.5 to 17 parts per billion in U.S. tuna. These differences can most likely be traced to different coatings used between the U.S. and Canada. And the data from the paper show that BPA concentrations tend to be tenfold higher in the actual canned food than in any liquid, like water, in which it had been packaged in the can. So yes, this may be the only place where you will be told that the heavy syrup is probably more healthy than the peaches. Here's the take-home message. Buy fresh food. Cook fresh food. Avoid canned foods until we are told that the liners are BPA-free. Simple as that. I suspect that you are probably as sick of these stories as I am. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Don't get rid of your mails just yet. They may be worth something. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.